Have you guys had an opportunity to read any of High Society yet?
I know that Hamlet has.
Hamlet has?
Yes, because he's talked about it in his writings. Yes.
Yeah, excellent. So, I mean, that's just such an extraordinary book. And when I that was like one of the last, not that this has ever ended, but that was just one of the kind of the foundational stones, if you will, or pillars to writing the book Integral Recovery. And I was traveling across eastern Colorado, which is, guys know or might not know, it's just vast open spaces. And there was an interview with Joseph Califano Jr. on NPR, and I went, holy cow, this is amazing. And I was going to Boulder, so I went down to the Boulder bookstore on Pearl Street, and they had one copy of it, and I snagged it, and it was just amazing. And what he does so admirably, I think, in that book is that he connects all the dots, as far as the United States is concerned. Let's very clear, we're talking about a book that talks about the extent of the drug problem in the US. But I think we can use the same kind of metrics and for whatever country we're dealing with, so if you're from Turkey or Russia or Mexico or whatever, you can look at this and just kind of connect all these dots. And when you do that, I think it is just a clarion call that doing things business as usual is just not enough. It hasn't been working. I'm getting pretty old, and I'm getting pretty old. I feel pretty young, but anyway, I was conscious in the '60s, is what I'm trying to say. And during the Nixon administration, they initiated the war on drugs. Boy, has that worked well. In the meantime, it's like when I was a kid, it's like the parents maybe had drinking problems, but and we had all the drug problems. Now everybody has drug problems generationally. I mean, how many students have I worked with? Well, dad was a meth addict or a crack addict or just smokes pot all day or whatever it is. So they've certainly just gone on and expanded. And I mean, look, and I grew up in Mexico. I moved down there when I was 4 years old, 1961, I think. Kennedy was president, so and I was 4 year old. I was politically aware. I know his name was John Kennedy, and Richard Nixon was running against him, and my brother's name was Richard, so I was a Kennedy supporter from early on. So a deep political analysis of what they were talking about. But anyway, yeah, and so since then it's just spread, and my beloved, Mexico has just been just torn apart by drugs and cartels and criminality, and there are whole sections of the country that the government doesn't even control, at this point. And my older brother is a he's an international security expert, and he works down in Mexico a lot, and there's places where they have warehouses for oil companies and to service these oil wells and stuff down in Mexico. And basically, they have guards, but it's, say, if the cartels show up, just let them in, because you've got a pistol, and they have, grenade launchers and AK-47s and machine guns. So, it's really, I mean, that's just anarchy, and that's been, largely brought on by our hunger for drugs in this country, this insatiable market. And I think it says in Califano books, and this is kind of mind blowing, that in 2005, $190 billion was spent on the treatment of cancer in our country, and $250 billion was spent on the treatment of addiction. And maybe, I mean, just super generously, maybe 10% of the people that needed treatment got it, and the treatment that's out there, as we know, that's why we're having this conversation and going over this course, it's just not that effective, and it's all, it's blown into a million different pieces. Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall, took a great fall, and all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And then Ken Wilber was born and gave them a map to start putting it back together. So that's what we're doing. One of the things we're doing, and we'll talk about what we're doing, the other part we're doing later. But yeah, so we can connect all the pieces. It's not just a law enforcement problem, although it's not, it's going to always be a law enforcement problem. It's not just a religious problem. It's not just a 12-step, group problem. I mean, it is a huge problem that just cuts across every, infects every dimension, every quadrant. None of us are 2 degrees removed from this problem. You could, I mean, if you live in a glass bubble and you've never met an addict, you can say, well, I pay taxes. And you know, how much of the money that comes out of our tax bill is because of wasted time, wasted money, law enforcement. In the United States, we have the largest prisoner population on the planet, percentage of citizens in jail at the moment. And 80% of those people are there because of drugs and alcohol related problems. And I recently had a student of mine who relapsed and struggled, and he got into meth. And he murdered a woman with a knife in cold blood. So, I mean, you know, so that's how heavy this thing is. And that's pretty close. And this guy would have not done that if it had not been for meth. You know, it was brutal. It was bloody. And he's in prison now. So anyway, I don't know why I got on that. I just want to make, you know, I'll give the big picture, but I keep on wanting referencing to real life experiences, and then we're not separated from this. It's everybody's problem, and it's not something, oh, well, just let, you know, the police and AA take care of it, because that hasn't been working. So, yeah, the good news is, oh my gosh, you probably won't be unemployed for the rest of your life if you want to work in this field, you know. So, and it's just tremendous. And I know some of the writing assignments, the first assignments is how addiction has affected your life. And I know this is powerful. I know a lot of people that are probably called to this program are probably people that are in personal recovery themselves from drugs or alcohol. And I don't think that necessarily means that you have to be a recovering addict to be an integral recovery healthcare provider, however you want to say that, coach, therapist, etc. It's certainly a valuable perspective. It's first person, but you know, it's in and of itself, it ain't enough. And, you know, I talk about the book when I was getting together Passages to Recovery, a program that I designed, a wilderness program to treat drugs and alcohol. You know, I was looking for, you know, recovery experts, and what passes recovery expert generally is somebody who has years of recovery experience themselves. And boy, but that didn't prepare them to be a wilderness guide. So I could get wilderness guides or I can get recovery guides, but I couldn't find a recovery guy who could survive in the wilderness. And so I was like, okay, we got to put these things together. And eventually I just had to be, you know, okay, I got to be it. You know, I'm going to have to become that person. Okay, God, you know, you should really have a better, you know, employment service than me. But I started functioning myself that way. And I would always feel guilty going to AA meetings because I couldn't say, hi, John, I'm an alcoholic. But I realized, you know, I was addicted to cigarettes for years and years and years. So I think I qualify for that party, you know. I know the cravings of drugs. I know what relapse is about. My last relapse happened, I don't know, 5 years for 10 years, right? But anyway, it happened a while ago, and I had that last cigarette on my porch, American Spirits, good old hippie, non, you know, chemical. Oh, you know, this is all natural. I'm with my friend. We're watching the sunset. It's like a chanupa, dude, you know, whatever my addict brain was saying. So it tasted terrible. I got all dizzy-headed. But then, you know, for 6 weeks, I'm the little thing, why don't you just go get a pack of cigarettes at the store? You can have one or two. I mean, come on. You deserve it. What are you talking? Shut up. No, come on, really. And I feel the craving. So I realized that just that one puff just got me going through that whole addict process for 6 weeks. And I'm so freaking done now. Oh, my gosh. You know, and I'm saying I'm invulnerable and everything, but I smell it on a person. I get ill, you know. It's like, and that's really what we want to do. You know, addiction, eventually it'll come like that. I think Bill W. said in the Big Book that eventually it's like putting your hand on a hot stove. I mean, yes. Drinking, he was talking about alcoholics. He just won't do it anymore, you know. And maybe some people will never get there, you know, but hopefully that is the goal. And that with practice and work and prayer and doing everything we put together and the exercise, that we'll get to the point where it's just so ridiculous. You know, it's just like, oh, I'm going to put my hand in a meat grinder? No, it's just not going to happen because I got a life. I got a goal, you know, and the highs that I get now and the purpose and the meaning and what I'm doing now is so, you know, meaningful that I'm just not, it's just ridiculous. You know, it's just like, I'm not going to take out a 22 and shoot my dog. You know, it's just that ridiculous. Just not going to do that. Not my dog, and maybe you're, anyway, let's not go there. So this is just a vast problem. And recently, about 2 years ago, Pam and I were invited to Honduras. a country I'd never been to in Latin America, in Central America. And I'm getting ready to go, and I get an email from my brother, the security expert, you know, international security expert, my big brother. And anyway, he sends me, you know, this is the most dangerous country in the world right now. I went, what? What about Afghanistan, you know, Iraq and Syria and all this stuff? I said, no, this is it. And so I said, well, we booked our tickets and we're going. And then when we got there, I got an email from the State Department saying, you know, American citizens should not go to Nicaragua at this time. And why am I talking about that? Because Nicaragua, you know, it's a beautiful, gorgeous country. I mean, it's got two coastlines, mountains, jungles, you know, sweet people. And it has just been dominated and torn apart by the drug world. You know, and you have extreme poverty, extreme wealth, struggling middle class, narcos, guys are everywhere and their pickups and their guns running around. I saw a guy that just, we were driving to go to Copan, an incredible Mayan ruin in Honduras. And I grew up in Mexico, so I've seen a lot of Mayan ruins, a lot of ruins in general. I'm a kind of a connoisseur of Mesoamerican ruins, if you will. And so I'm kind of a ruin snob. And boy, when I got to Copan, I was blown away. It's so beautiful. But we were stopped by the police like five or six times, roadblocks, which is kind of scary. And I saw a guy that had just gotten killed. We drove by, and he was lying there. He was obviously dead, and people were white, you know, I mean, just shock. And then we drove by and saw, it looked like gang guys had a guy tied up, and they were just beating him on the side of the street, you know. And this is like, it's incredible. And anyway, and because of my practice, I really opened up to a lot of the suffering in this country, this beautiful country that's just been brought to, you know, not just because of drugs. Obviously, there's other systemic problems there too, you know, different levels and lines and stages and all the stuff that we can use with looking at a country politically through the integral map. But just the drug problem, and they don't grow drugs, by the way. In Nicaragua, what it is, it's the halfway point for all the drugs that are coming from South America into the United States. And apparently they have all these clandestine airports and runways and stuff like that where they bring and haul the drugs. But it's just taken over the country and made it very, very dangerous. And, you know, the people that we were staying with, our friends, are pretty wealthy, you know, and very wealthy. But, you know, they all have armed guards with machine guns, you know, with guarding their castles and stuff like this. You know, it's a disaster, and they've all been threatened and mugged, and the people with money drive around in bulletproof vehicles, and it's just like, holy mackerel. And so much of that is because of the drug problem that we have never been able successfully deal with in our country. If the demand for drugs went away in America overnight, some, you know, magic thing, the problem in Nicaragua would also be immensely more manageable and better. And anyway, when I was meditating there at the time at our friend's house, I just got this, it was almost a very deep spiritual experience. And I just realized that from kind of a spiritual, integral level, that the solution includes love for everyone. I mean, love for, you know, I was staying with a wealthy family, you know, and it's like the old radical left wing, eat the rich, right? Well, no, these are lovely people struggling, you know, in their thing, and the poor and the middle class and the narco guys, the poor guys that had to get into some kind of sociopathic criminal thing because they couldn't make a living any other way or support their families. And so there was just this kind of illumination how this is a huge systemic problem, but that there is really care. It's a win-win-win-win-win situation, which is what happens when we get to the integral level of development or even the cosmocentric when we talk about developmental lines. So it was a real revelation. I was like, oh my God, in the middle of all this suffering, because you can get really angry, you know, let's just go, you know, kick in the doors and take all these people out. And, you know, that may be what you have to do in some situations. Sometimes love, you know, has to shoot something. I mean, you know, love means defending and protecting too, but coming from that place of deep, deep caring, it was really extraordinary, and it kind of shifted my whole worldview about this thing. And of course, my book is really focused on the individual and families. I mean, you got to start somewhere, right? But as we continue to grow and work in this field, we're going to have to deal with, you know, larger lower right or quadrant issues. as well. And of course, lower left, cultural expectations, all of this stuff. So we really need to expand this. Again, the book is the first step, not the last step. And all of us need to, you know, include this in our awareness and our consciousness. And one thing that Ken Wilber said one time is that, and this just really moves me when I'm thinking about an integral approach to, if not eliminating addiction, just making big turnaround, you know, cutting down, you know, instead of, you know, being able to help 10% of people, if we could increase it to 50%, you know, God, we'd all win Nobel prizes and, you know, feel really good about ourselves. But he says, you know, a nation, a country, a society has a duty, a moral obligation to protect its children. And we just freaking haven't been able to do that. You know, it's like, kids shouldn't have to say, just say no. You know, what? You know, when my dad was growing up, you know, in the Depression and stuff, they didn't have to worry about, you know, crack. And I mean, there was alcohol. Sure, that was always there, but it wasn't to this extent. So one of the things when we're talking to all levels, okay, and dealing with this problem where it's, you know, we'll talk about red, amber, blue, you know, red being kind of egocentric warrior, amber, blue being the fundamentalist level, really short versions of it, orange, capitalism, modernism, blah, blah, and then green is postmodern, counterculture, hippie, green, yoga, all that good stuff. I mean, you can talk about, we need to protect our children. That hits everybody in the heart because everybody loves their children. So that's a really good integral doorway into talking about this problem, mm-hmm. and just the vast scope of it. And we all have our stories. We've all lost people. We've all lost friends. And if they weren't personal friends, then there are our, you know, our cultural friends, our musical heroes. Our, you know, Philip Hoffman just died. What a bummer, you know. In my case, River Phoenix. You know, when I grew up, I was a member of this kind of toxic fundamentalist religious group. Another story, but for another time. But when I was at this commune back in, must have been 1972, he was there, you know, and his brothers, Joaquin, and they were just like little kids, and I was like, you know, big old 14-year-old. So, but they were there, and so we had that shared thing, and you know, and shortly, I was in grad school in the Bay Area, and shortly before he died, you know, and all the press was about him. Oh, this guy is just the most enlightened. He eats, you know, vegetarian. He just loves the world, everything. And he had a huge major drug issue that was just being not out there. And then he went to a, you know, a club and overdosed. Oh, and before that, I had this kind of thing that maybe I should contact them. And in my pride, but oh man, you want to go? Everyone has to contact, you know, Mr. Superstar, movie actor and stuff. And then he died, and I just felt so deeply affected by that, you know. And when I was growing up, we lost Jim Morrison and Janis Joplin, and oh my gosh, my still guitar teacher mentor, Jimi Hendrix, mm-hmm. you know, 27, all this stuff. So it's just enormous, and I think we tend to just kind of dissociate and just accept it as the given. You know, people just, there's drugs everywhere, and people die and get addicted and blah, 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 blah. But I think when we're looking at the big picture that we can start to, you know, make a difference. And I've been contacted by presidents of countries or president of a country, and it's starting to, you know, they're concerned about this because real leaders and real politicians that really love their people, and there are politicians like that, believe it or not, they're out there serving, and there are a lot of them actually. So, you know, they're going to have to look at this. So we need to be able to speak from an integral level about the big picture as well as the individual family and, you know, the kind of more upper left and upper right and lower left, but in a smaller basis. So there has to be big policy changes. And I think that, as you guys know from the reading my book and the previous lectures, that I think the way out of this thing is through an integral practice, you know, dedicated and not the smorgasbord. You know, I mean, God bless IOP box that came out of Integral Life. It was a revolutionary leap forward. but it was also kind of, well, this is started, you know, you kind of put your thing together. With addicts, you don't hand them a huge menu of practices. You're like, well, what's your favorite practice? Well, I like cooking heroin in a spoon. Okay. No, anyway, so you have to be pretty, especially in the early days, and people that are really kind of really far in the progression, you know, they're getting ready to die if they don't quit. You just need to be very directive and say, this is what you do. Keep it simple, stupid. And this is your lifeline to saving your life. And I will just be there and guilt trip you and bully you and give you inspiring speeches and, you know, hold you up when you puke or whatever to get you doing the practices. And, you know, and so it's very directive. And basically what I say there is you do this type of meditation technology that we have now that is so powerful and accessible and democratic and allowing us to rebalance the chemistry of the brain, allowing us to have a deep, experiential, personal, spiritual life. Okay, spirituality is a practice. Allows us to get smarter and healthier and better. Then we need to get to these people exercising their bodies as if their lives depended on it, because they do. And eating the right food and, you know, supplements. I'm a big favor of that. And those are the three basic things. And of course, you have to get the education along with it. You know, the integral map, as far as they're able to understand it at whatever level they're at. I have a client from Latin America who, you know, couldn't wrap his head around Opus, not rather around 12 steps because of the cultural blah, blah in the area that he lives in. So he got connected to Opus Dei, which is a very kind of conservative Catholic thing that we all think is just some of this horrible thing because of this movie we saw with, what was it? What was the name of the film?
Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, with this guy with torturing himself and this sociopath. Like, well, that's not a good spiritual path. But anyway, if you go back to Jose Maria Escriva, I think is his name. That's right. It's really about spiritual practice. And he was really, I think the guy was a saint. He was a very saintly guy, that's what I'm read. So anyway, all that to say is that he went, he joined that and worked in that, and they provided him, Opus Dei, a lot of the basic spiritual fundamentals structure that's provided by AA. So, you know, I'm just sitting there working with a client and talking about his Opus Dei experience, and so far it's been all positive. And, you know, I don't know if it turns in, at the later stages, it turns into, you know, Da Vinci Code, but from what I'm seeing, it's very, very supportive, and he's developed the kind of the witness self because of his practice. So he's able to kind of see into it and what is good. He's not just like drinking the Kool-Aid unconsciously, but it's been a great support level for him. So all that to say is that we can culturally work very intelligently with whatever is available to our clients and in their particular countries and their spaces. So, yes. And the other thing I wanted to say about this big, you know, the worldwide dimensions of this thing, planet-wide. And by the way, it's not just human family that this thing is hurting. It's hurting animals, okay? How many, you know, these dogs and pit bulls and stuff have been, you know, treated, tortured and stuff to protect crack houses and, you know, and you know, when they have these meth labs, they dump all that, the byproducts, these toxic stuff down the toilet into the water system. I mean, it's just a disaster for all life forms. When human beings go sociopathic and they go criminal, which is what drug addiction causes us to do as we devolve into the depths of it, we don't care about anything. So we hurt everything and everybody and all creatures. So this is just huge. Beyond just the human family, it's all our, you know, our fellow travelers in this co-evolutionary journey that we're on. So I think if we look at addiction like that, why is it important to have this big thing? You know, why is it important at all? I just can't drink and I have to figure out, you know, what I have to do not to do that. Because I think at the higher levels of moral development and caring, that there is just more of a clearer picture of what matters, you know, and why we should actually do this work. And, you know, some of your students may not be willing to hear this big picture stuff, and some of them might be. I mean, usually the first revelation, as you guys know, when you start getting sober, it's like, oh my God, you know, what have I been doing? Not just me, but to my family. You know, I've been in this addictive trance that, hey, man, it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters to me, you know, I'm an island. I can do what I want. You live your life, I'll live mine. It's all good. No, it's not all good. Tremendous betrayal and hurt. And we are connected and we are responsible for one another, you know, and it's not just me. You know, big revelation. If there's ever, you know, one big message that comes from all the spiritual traditions, it's not just about me or the little me. It's about the big me. That includes all of us. So, so I think it's important to have this dimension to speak about it. And I think the promise of integral recovery, kind of the cutting edge that I'm kind of seeing into now, is that what if we start these integral practices with the young people? I probably mentioned this before. What if we start, you know, doing the interior work and the physical work and the emotional work and the spiritual work and intellectual work before they get to the point where they need to take drugs? When they start, you know, the respect and the joy and the connectedness and the purposefulness and the love that emerges from an integral practice is, I believe, will really inoculate a lot of people from ever having to take those steps, you know, because I think people take drugs because they often feel disenfranchised and disassociated and they don't belong to anything anymore. So why the hell not do something that makes you feel better? And Guy Duplessis sent me an article from an academic. I think he was a neo-Marxist, but he completely reduced the problem of addiction to a lower right dimension. And we're just talking about, you know, these tribal peoples who have been taken off their lands and put into reservations and disassociated and disenfranchised have like the largest percentage of addiction in the world, like in the reservations in the United States. I mean, sometimes alcoholism, not to mention methamphetamines now and these other drugs, like 90%. Can you freaking imagine 90%? It's horrible, you know. And I've had Native American teachers, so that just brutalizes my heart. It hurts so much that's going on. And while I think this particular author was trying to reduce it all to just a lower right causative agent, if you will, I don't think that's true, because all four quadrants are indicated, and they can, you know, and they have to be included. But it's a super, super compelling, good argument. So as well as, you know, working with children, we also have to work towards economic justice, right? So a poverty and despair, no future, no hope are huge problems. And when you don't feel like you're a stakeholder in your culture, in your country, in your world, why not just self-annihilate and check out for the siren's call of temporary states of bliss that drugs provide, okay? So when you start learning, you know, what the alternative is, which is much deeper, much better, more truly joyful, and even allows you to suffer nobly, you know, we still suffer. It's just we don't want to rob people of their suffering, but we want noble suffering. I mean, suffering that leads to growth and compassion and connection and annihilation of our false, you know, structures. But we don't want useless, annihilating, suicidal, homicidal, pathological, sociopathic suffering. You know, that's the stuff that we want to eliminate. But we're going to have to truly, truly do it from a deeply four-quadrant perspective. So hopefully, you know, this is kind of a help to start us seeing more intricately and more fully, you know, because we can get very, you know, we can get very limited just to kind of the recovery world, the 12-step meeting, or the treatment center or whatever. But I'm just trying to give a 50,000 foot overview of this problem and issue. So yeah, well, that was a nice opening gambit. So any questions or comments at this point?
I want to allow for others. I have a few thoughts, but Derek, Eddie, and Hamlet, any responses or questions you have for John?
Sure, I'll go.
Go for it.
Yeah, it just, I've been sort of making notes as you were doing that awesome little intro rant, and some of the things that stood out for me. I'm more integrally informed than recovery informed. From my experience, my particular vice is actually food, and in particular, sugar, which sort of seems kind of soft listening to a lot of what, you know, John, you were talking about. But it is a real problem. It's a real addiction. And so I'm kind of interested in how maybe the less seemingly serious addiction of sugar addiction is sort of fits into this kind of big drug problem. There's going to be more and more awareness of this in the next year. This amazing documentary, Fed Up, that's coming out all about the effect of sugar on populations and on, especially in America. And so I'm interested in seeing where that kind of fits together. And one of the things that you said, John, it fits so well into my own experience, because you said, you know, I'm not going to stick my hand into the meat grinder now, right? I'm not going to take that on. I see that as, you know, as this poison, right? Now that I have identified this poison in the world, I'm not going to take it in. So getting people to that point where they can see that is key. I also thought of something because you said, you know, about Nicaragua. You know,
it's Honduras.
Say that again.
Honduras, I think I said.
Okay. You were talking about, I thought it was Nicaragua, maybe it was Honduras, but you know, you were saying that if we got rid of the drug problem here, suddenly, you know, they've also got it much better. And I wonder, this question came up, does legalization in America help Nicaragua, whereas now it creates another huge problem for America? That's an interesting question.
Yes.
So I don't know, it's something to think about.
Yeah, well, let me respond to both. They're really both good points. The sugar thing, of course, you know, it's legal and it's just everywhere. But I read a book one time, The History of Sugar, I think, or something like that. And they just started talking about, you know, when sugar cane, you know, when the Spanish came over and the European colonialists, and they started bringing sugar back. Well, that gave rise to the slave trade. They need people to. This was before cotton was discovered in the South, and it gave rise to the horror of the Middle Passage and slavery and criminality. And I just, like, tremendous, like we were talking about from a four quadrant historic perspective, awful stuff. And it just, I mean, it is an addiction. It brutalizes our children, their bones, our physical, mental, spiritual health. It's just a real problem. It hasn't been my focus of work, but I find more and more that people will pick up my book or get the integral idea and they'll start applying it to that. So I think that's that would be a brilliant area of specialization, you know, that you could run with. It would be a total gift for the world, and you'd never be unemployed. And you know, apply this. And I'm amazed at the inventiveness of people that contact me. Because like I said, I've had people that contact me. They're not alcoholics and they're not drug addicts, but they're maybe a sex addict or work addict or this, or you know, depression or lost the way. And they apply everything in the book for as a general model to help them work through that. So, yeah. And right. And the legalization thing. Well, let's just see. Okay. I just got back from Boulder, and you know, marijuana is legal. So I always smelled it in Boulder, but now I smell it, and it's just like, but it's legal, you know. And Pam went with some friends to a little town near there, and she actually went into a marijuana shop, you know, and all, you know, all this stuff. And it's just like, for those of us, when I was growing up in Texas, you know, people were getting two joints for getting 30 years in jail. You know, it's just maybe a little bit of an overreaction. But now it's legal in Washington and in Colorado. So I'm guardedly optimistic because, you know, even though it's just strictly a lower right response, okay, the war is not working. Let's see what we can do. Maybe if we make it legal, it'll solve some of the problems. Maybe it'll take some of the criminal money out of it. Okay, and so we can kind of cut down on the pressure to bring these illegal drugs. I know in the Bay Area when I lived there, the number one cash crop at that point in California was marijuana. You know, it wasn't tomatoes, it wasn't grapes, it wasn't oranges, you know, avocados, it was pot. And the feds really started coming down on that. And then the use of hard drugs really expanded. And first of all, let me say again about marijuana. Of all the addictive substances, and yes, Lucy, marijuana is addictive. well, it's just psychological. Whatever. If your psyche's craving marijuana all the time, what's the difference between that and your body craving it? To me, the psyche and the body, how do you separate that? Anyway, and it's not for everyone, just like these other drugs. But if you have to stay smoked out all the time just to feel normal, and you run out of pot and you start freaking out, and you run all over trying to find pot, well, I'd say that it gets you into the game as addiction, you know? So, however, that said, I'd much rather deal with a pothead any day of the week than an alcoholic. I think our number one legal drug, besides nicotine, is much more destructive than pot. So, that to say, yeah, they're taxing it. They're really controlling the sources now. Especially, I know about Colorado, not so much about Washington, but, you know, they grow pot in these highly protected areas. They're filmed 24 hours a day with video cameras and stuff like that. So that, I think it could really eliminate some problems, but it's going to cause some other problems. So the kind of blue, you know, response, it's a sin, it's illegal, you're going to jail thing has not worked. But this is coming probably from a more orange-green level. So it's the old ways weren't working, so they tried something different. But it's perhaps going to cause new problems. But no, it's new problems caused at a higher level of moral development. So those will have to be dealt with. In the short term, you're probably going to have more people smoking pot, you know. And, you know, you're going to have like our friend of ours is there visiting from Holland, and he got a taxi driver who was obviously inebriated on pot, and he just ran off the road and bumped into him. He says, I always miss that turn, dude. You know, so it's like, you know, so it's going to cause some other problems too. But maybe we'll start being a little more sane about our responses to it instead of just demonizing it. And, you know, President Obama said, and I paraphrased recently, you know, that pot's no worse than alcohol. And he was, you know, I disagree. I mean, I agree with the sentiment, but I think alcohol is much more damaging than pot, you know. So hopefully, and I mean, we were just in Holland, and they're really starting, you know, it's a very green country, developmentally, spiral dynamically speaking, you know. And they've had, you know, legalized pot and stuff for years, and they're beginning to kind of withdraw that. They're you know, the coffee houses, it's weird. It's like the Catch-22. You can smoke pot in there legally, but you can't sell it legally to a coffee. So you're creating a criminal problem right there. But their issue was, and some of the Dutch that I talked to, you know, Amsterdam is, you know, one of the most beautiful cities in the world, culturally and architecturally, and it's the canals, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful place. It says, we want to be known for that. We want people to come for that, not because we're the stoner capital of Europe. You know, it's like, okay, I got it. Yeah, so anyway, I think it's an approach, a lower right approach from a higher level. I think it will solve some problems and create new problems, so we'll have to deal with that, you know, hopefully intelligently as we do that. And hopefully it'll cut down on people maybe drinking or people using meth and crack and stuff like that. But I'm just guardedly optimistic, you know. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your
question? I agree. Yeah. Everything that you were with what you were saying. I'm also curious. I don't want to take all the time. I'm sure that Hamlet and Eddie have stuff to mention as well. But I was curious if you had looked into any of the Ibogaine treatment facilities that are kind of popping up in Mexico and things like this to help people with addiction. That's an interesting, you know. Again, at least it's affecting the upper right. You know, it's starting there.
Yeah. Well, then let me. I'll say a little bit about that also. I think that, you know, I know about Ibogaine, and I've had some students that show up at my group had gone to Europe to do Ibogaine, and they relapsed tremendously on heroin, or people that go down to do ayahuasca, you know, in Peru or Ecuador or wherever they do that stuff. And, you know, I think that they're in an evolved world, that there is a place for these healer plants and even psychedelics. You know, but it has to be done very, very wisely. And it also has to be done with an integral understanding, okay, that all these things are doing are creating state experiences. Very powerful state experiences, but state experiences in and of themselves will not heal addiction. So it could be a very, Bill W., toward the end of his life, wanted everybody in AA to do acid. You know, because he was using acid when it was legal, and he was having these great spiritual experiences. And if you read guy who plays E's analysis of AA in the workbook, which is totally brilliant. And the real foundational inspiration of AA is that through a spiritual awakening, through a metanoia experience that people could overcome, and only through a spiritual experience and opening in life could people overcome the ravages of alcoholism. So within that context, but if you just think that traveling to Africa or traveling to Europe or traveling to South America and getting dosed for a couple of weeks is going to cure you of addiction, I haven't seen it yet. I haven't anybody told me about that. I've heard, you know, vague stories about it. But if it could be, you know, skillfully worked into an integral model where, okay, yeah, these big, you know, illuminating flashes are nice, but it has to be stabilized and grounded with an ongoing lifetime interior practice, then we might have something that's really useful given that. So
That's brilliant. That's what's missing, because it is. It's stuck in the state experience. It's not getting into the developmental process.
And we didn't get it in the 60s. So like, we, you know, there's God. Here's, you know, non-duality. Oh, my God, there's so much more to reality. Vastly, infinitely deeper than the drugs would wear off, and we were all messed up. And not understanding that. And then Ken just explains states and stages. It's like, ding, of course. You know, and that stages work with ongoing discipline, meditative discipline, become the building blocks for higher stages of development. You know, and you figure that out. And I'm sure that these substances and plant helpers and psychedelics use wisely, intricately. But you know what? The fact is, if you're not integral, nothing works. When you think about it, I mean, it's not just psychedelics. It's like politics. It's like family. It's like individual development. And I mean, I say that coming from an integral level, because when you look at it, just a flatland approach to anything, you just like, it's almost despairing. You know, I mean, how can you eliminate poverty without an integral approach? Because poverty is not just a physical thing, although that has to be dealt with, right? It's an interior thing. It's a cultural thing. It's an individual. It's a physical thing. So anyway, I think now that we kind of have the tools to look at things and to see things differently and to start moving, and just the fact that I can make that analysis, which is, you know, probably pretty high in analysis, just got the damn map that I, you know, that I can see that now. And I struggled with those very same questions, you know, what is this? And I went through a period of experimenting with psychedelics in the early 80s. I was in the Bay Area. I was in San Francisco, actually. And so I was like, you know, like 6.5 blocks from Haight-Ashbury, something like that. So I kind of felt that I was in a historically relevant area. But, you know, I went to Haight-Ashbury and it's like, you know, it's really kind of dark. I mean, just alcoholics and, you know, I mean, really messed up homeless people and kind of criminality. And Love Street didn't last for long. And, and I experienced a lot of these really powerful, powerful state experiences. But it wasn't transforming me. I mean, it was giving me a taste, but I was more tormented by the fact that when I came back from these experiences, I was more, you know, as messed up as I ever was, but I was more aware of it. So finally, I think that was one of the motivations, both consciously and unconsciously, that this whole drug thing doesn't seem to be working. Oh, and because I was a musician, I was invited into the nascent rave scene, going out and invading warehouses and taking over and doing these things spontaneously. And it was very kind of, at that point, it's very idealistic, all love and everything, you know, all brought on mainly by ecstasy and LSD. And but I just saw the people that I knew beginning to crash and burn through the overuse, especially ecstasy. I mean, enough LSD will be very damaging too, but ecstasy just screws up the serotonin system and so much, you know, and it's a speedy drug, you know. And I just saw people overdoing it, no guidance, you know, and it was depressing, quite frankly, because there had been a lot of idealism, but I saw it was, again, like the 60s movement in San Francisco, very idealistic, and it crashed on the hard reality of addictive substances, you know. And so Bob, you wanna anybody else, but especially Bob.
Well, so let's check in with Eddie and Hamlet. I'm happy to contribute, but Hamlet, or Eddie?
Yeah. Hi, Tammy. John, I have a question. Do you have any experience or have you heard of any studies or experiments done with integrally informed recovering addicts using psychedelics in a controlled environment?
No. I've had integrally informed people that I'd previously worked with go do these things against my advice, you know, because I think especially, so there's two issues here. You know, theoretically, maybe this is a good thing if it's held with a really controlled environment with an integral life practice thing that's already initiated before they go and support when they get back and all this stuff. But for the addict, I mean, it's the compulsion just to alter one's consciousness.
Right.
All the time. Yeah. And a lot of times, you know, they're looking for the magic wand of, you know, this is a really good drug, finally, that'll fix me. And I think I would want to see a number of years of real stable recovery and real just super dedication to the practice, integral practice, before my students anyway go into that world. Because right now, well, the studies don't exist that I know of, and definitely the supportive structures don't exist to support that kind of thing. So maybe it's a promise, but from what I've seen, it didn't feel right in my gut, and I can tell you why it didn't feel right, because I think it was just chasing highs again. And that whole chase can end up having people relapse, and I saw it happen. So that's not a huge, you know, study, that's been my personal experience. Right. So I'd be very, very cautious, you know.
Right.
And I have worked with clients that have gone and done it and have survived. You know, it didn't seem to be a super, super powerful. Well, you know, anyway, they survived and they went on and kept on with the work. But it just really put them into, in one client in particular, deep into the shadow process that we already knew was there, which she's already working through, but it just really brought that up, and we continue to work on it.
Okay. John, I've got a question. I just came out of a meeting yesterday with a group here locally that I do some supervision for, and we were addressing the upper right quadrant in terms of nutrition. And one of the conversations that came up in that group meeting, we had an interventionist who came and joined us, and we had just kind of an informal conversation about how is it that conversations might evolve in the recovery community. I'm looking at you, Derek, thinking of your comment that you're more integrally informed than recovery informed. How do we, I know that you know that I care a lot about this, John. How do we help evolve the conversation to become ever more inclusive? Whether it's talking about the lower right and society, culture, economics, or the upper right. And I'm thinking about the conversation yesterday in our meeting was that there's so little apparent attention to developments in the last 75 years since the big book was written and AA was spawned to whether it's nutrition, which was the topic of conversation yesterday, or social cultural variables, which is implied throughout our conversation today. Just any thoughts that you have, John, beyond the four or five of us here that are involved today in this phone conversation, thoughts about how, and I also have to tell all of you, I just came from my own AA meeting this morning, realizing that the bandwidth of the typical conversation in meetings like that, while meaningful, is very very narrow, very limited, and I feel an ethical piece inside of myself how to expand this. And I have one-on-one conversations before meetings, after meetings, or we have a small group conversation today here, or a small group conversation at my work yesterday. But in the meantime, large numbers of people kind of languish in. I'm stating that strongly, but kind of languish in a non-integrally informed perspective. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts about what I'm saying.
Yeah. Anybody wanna
take
a swing at that ball?
It's, you know, all of these other things that are out there, they are a partial piece of the puzzle, right? To me, until I figured out integral, until I discovered integral, I only had a little partial pieces of it. Integral comes along and suddenly, wow. So getting people to see the partiality of it, getting them to see you're only looking at one aspect of it. What about this over here? You know, get some of this in line.
Yeah.
You know, I love that in the book, John, you talk about how the first thing you do is give people a handful of supplements. Right, get their physical already starting, and that sets it up. So get them to see that there's a connection between all of these things, and I think it will start to snowball from there. I mean, that's my intuition.
Yeah,
and I'm very much an intuitive, you know, guy on a spiritual path, and so I kind of do what I know I'm supposed to do, what's right there in front of my face, like being here and talking with you guys, and then I just trust God to do the rest because I'm not a big running another company, we went through this thing, well, let's get the 5-year plan. And I said, this sounds a lot like, you know, Stalinist Russia, and these plans never work, you know, and I can't figure out what I'm going to do next week, you know, my 5-year plan, why should I waste time doing that? And maybe there is something good about that, but that's not how I lead or how I operate. So I pray a lot, and I say, okay, God, you want me to talk to anybody, whatever you want me to do today, help me not to be, you know, in the way so much that I can't get it done. And then things start kind of just unfolding.
Let me interrupt for just a second, John. And part of it is I have to leave in just a couple minutes, but I have a thought that's related to this. And I'm looking at you, Derek, thinking of your earlier comments about addiction to sugar and food. I've got a student here at Cal Southern that's doing her doctoral dissertation on treating sugar addiction. She's the director in the Los Angeles area. She's the clinical director of all the Matrix clinics here in greater Los Angeles. So she's very influential in that system, the Matrix model out of Minnesota. And what she's told me is that for her to take a model that was developed for alcohol and drug addiction and apply it to what makes a lot of sense, to apply it to sugar and other forms of eating, disordered eating and so on, is that she has no support within the Matrix people for that. In other words, just to move it to a slightly different population, zero support. She's practically cut off. And I'd actually like to link her with you, Derek, because of your interest in an integral perspective. Coming back from Boulder, I recommended to Catherine your book, John, just to try to begin to open up conversation. But it's ironic to me that it has to happen outside of this governing organization, which is a nationwide organization on treatment of addiction, but it's so narrowly defined. No, we don't talk about sugar. We talk about alcohol and heroin. It's just, what the heck? You know, it's that kind of provincialism or narrowness that comes up in lots of different forms, but that's a recent form. And one of my goals is to link these people up with people like you, John, or like you, Derek, because there's a hunger to spread the word, and yet there's this sectarianism I run into a lot in the recovery world, including within the 12-step world, and it pains me.
And maybe she would be a good guest lecturer, you know, as part of this thing. I think that would be absolutely fascinating.
Thank you. She'd be game on. Let's get her through the dissertation process. Let's see if we can get it to be integrally informed, but you know, what's intuitively obvious to anybody who's a clinician, for example, is not obvious in the governing structure within that organization. And this isn't about Matrix. This could be almost any organization within recovery oftentimes has this sense of kind of territorial or turfdom or whatever you want to call it. And it's a lost resource, it seems like to me.
You know, and also it's like we don't have to have people necessarily that are integrally informed. It's nice if we do, but you know, with integral mind, you can listen to anybody who's informed on a piece of it, and you see it automatically. You start doing all the connections, whether they get it or not. You know, and that's a way we can you know deal with massive amounts of information value that's coming from any level of development, and fit it into our integral structure. And that's one of the real skills that as we practice with this stuff that we're able to do. And again, you know, the universe really starts to make sense. You know. It may be hard, may be difficult. So, but it really truly does begin to make sense, and it's just a different, just shifts everything.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I've got to excuse myself. I'm going to leave the machine running. I wish you all blessings. And I'll be in touch with you, Derek, in terms of possibly if you're interested, linking you up to this student. But she would have ears to hear your interests.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds amazing. Thank you.
Awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. Take care.
Awesome, Bob. Thanks a lot, man. So, yeah, we're about wrapping it up. We, you know, like everybody's got a busy life around here, and it's meant to be about an hour. Are any questions about any of the material or anything else or comments in closing?
Nope, not for me.
Okay, the big 2.0 2.0 is coming out the beginning of next month, I think around the 4th or the 5th. And so I talk about all this stuff there. So that'll be a nice boost for hopefully for our school here. And in the meantime, I'm just glad that you guys are here and that your presence is really, you know, awesome. And I've learned this thing, whether I'm talking to two people or one person or 10,000, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter to me one bit. You know, it's like, it's just my calling is what I do. And I can't. It's just so. Anyway, it's felt really, really good to be here with you guys. So,
thank you, John. Same here.
And yeah, good. Yeah,
this was great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, and I could say a lot more. So, but anyway, I won't, blessedly. And we'll see you guys next week. So, really, 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 really study hard. Oh, and I will say one last thing before on Easter Sunday. You know, we have a meditation group that meets here last Sunday, and Pam read. A quote from some Zen master, and he was making a point about a lot of things, but the phrase that I've heard before that was really reinforced in my mind, he talked about heroic practice. So if we really, really, really want to do a good job, if we really want to be the kind of integral recovery leaders that our planet needs, you guys are really going to have to adapt that ethos, that ethic of heroic practice, whether it's diving into the material and really getting this stuff, knowing it inside out, or your own interior work and your own physical work and your intellectual and spiritual work and emotional work. So it's not half-assed. Half-assed doesn't get us there. Heroic effort does. So, just, you know, that's it. All right, you guys. Thank you so much. Remember office hours and, you know, text us, email us, you know, if you have any questions, stuff that comes up, okay?
Great. Thank you, John.
All right, guys.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.